right there?
I'm just kind of testing levels at this point, but yeah. Hello, welcome to our second interview with Dr. Earl Levin. we're talking about other planning initiatives that he was involved with over the course of his career and general thoughts on planning.
Thank you for such a pleasant introduction. As I indicated to you, I don't really know how any of the projects in Northern Canada that I was involved in as a representative or as the planner on behalf of the Central Mortgage and Housing Corporation. So I really can't say how successful any of them were, but in terms of the production of a plan and the acceptance of the plan locally, I suppose that's a small measure of success, whether the ideas itself, the plan itself, ever came to maturity or not, I have no way of knowing.
Right.
And then I went to Regina, just from the province of Saskatchewan. And the problem there was that the province had the authority to produce a development plan, which consisted of a zoning bylaw and a building permit authority, and a major street system. But unfortunately, the local municipalities had the authority to either build or not build, and to implement any of the ideas, so that if you produced a plan for a place, if they weren't interested, it didn't happen. Nothing could happen.
Somewhat like you were describing with Metropolitan Winnipeg.
Yes, same thing exactly. Same thing exactly. So it's very difficult to say how successful they were, except that in some instances, you see, we had no control over Regina and Saskatoon. The planning, so-called planning authority, applied only to those municipalities other than Regina and Saskatoon. And these were all rural-oriented communities. And the only developmental problems they had was in housing. Had to house the rural population, which was resident in those towns. And again, if they didn't like to implement any of the ideas, there was no obligation on them to do it. So that was so much for...
Right.
But there was one town, as I recall it, that was really interested in what I was doing. That was Humboldt. Humboldt was a very, very interested in what I had to say and in our discussions. The other places, they were really quite indifferent to the planning ideas. They were rural and they were mainly farm communities, and the only problems that they had, the only developmental problems they had, was, in fact, in housing, incoming population. And there wasn't a hell of a lot of that coming into Saskatchewan at that time, so that was it. And then, one of the projects that I think was successful was Lanigan. Lanigan was a small place, but it was discovered that it was in the midst of the potash deposits. And one of the major financial resources, a millionaire, I suppose, was interested in investing in potash. And you have a room here dedicated to Sam Drach.
Right, right.
And Sam Drach was a very wealthy man, mm-hmm. and was interested in exploiting the potash resources. So he asked me to prepare a plan for Lanigan, which was in the center of the potash area. And then there was a German corporation that was also interested in investing. And they were delighted with the proposal that I made for Lanigan, so much so that they gave me a gift of a book called So Wollen wir Wohnen, which is, this is how we like to live.
Oh, yeah?
Or here's where we like to, photographs and in German. I think that it collapsed, the whole idea didn't get very far. I'm not sure that the scheme that I prepared for Lanigan was ever implemented, or in fact that ever a Lanigan development corporation was ever created. But I just didn't get back to it. And I was only there for 4 years, from 56 to 60. But Humboldt as a town, and Lanigan as a potential accommodation for an industrial population, never came to pass. But the interesting thing about all of these places was that they had a very limited scope, a very limited idea, a limited vision of the urban development. Streets and residences was all that they were interested in. I suppose those interests led to the provision of a land use, that is a plan showing the street system as it might be required with a proposed possible residential development, although the residential development was so slow that it really didn't compose a planning issue. They really didn't need any planning because they were very small. But before I left, I produced a draft Professional Planning Act, a Community Planning Profession Act for the province of Saskatchewan. It was just a draft, I mean, after all, and that went to the legal department, and apparently they turned it into a legal document in 1963, and it is the Professional Planning Profession Act, at least it's, I think the full title is the Community Planning Profession Act in Saskatchewan.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And how it's faring, I don't know whether it's being used or not. Yeah. So, well, and then, again, when I left Saskatchewan, I went to work in Toronto for Murray E. Jones Company. And we did some interesting projects like Hamilton and Windsor and Prince Albert. again, I was only there for 3 years, 65 to 68,
right.
And I don't know how those actually turned out.
Right.
And from there, from Toronto, and Murray Jones, where I was the vice president of the company, whatever, I went to Metropolitan Winnipeg. And again, I was there for 4 years, from 1968 until the Metropolitan government was dissolved. It's 1972. But the problem there, again, was the fact that although the central office, or the planning office in Winnipeg, could propose street systems and sewer systems and housing development and that sort of thing, the local authority could simply say, we're not interested.
Right.
We want to approve this street plan, or we won't provide the services, or we won't do any of the necessary developmental, the actual on-the-ground developmental work. So I don't really know how any of that turned out. But that was pretty good. The projects that were there was a 4 year stint, and it was mainly working at a level for which I knew that there would not be any enthusiasm for the implementation of the proposals. And whatever proposals I made, I had no idea how they worked out. For example, the port-a-park system, which I thought was a very cute idea, it suggested that wherever there was a blank wall of a building next to an undeveloped adjacent area, that adjacent area might possibly be developed as a park. And I called it a port-a-park, because if the circumstances finally emerge that site was required, the park could be ported to another location. And the blank wall could carry a mural advertising the interests of the company that was sort of financially involved in the port park.
Right.
And there were two or three that were actually very successful while they lasted. But in the end, they had to be abandoned because they became the sleeping beds of the vagrants, and a lot of the material, the planting, for example, the landscaping, etc., was simply removed from them. So yeah, that wasn't a very long-lived venture, although during the short period in which it did live, it served a useful purpose. And I think was an interesting planning idea, where you made use of a blank wall and a vacant space to turn them into an attractive site in the city, mind you, a very limited site. So that was it. And then
take cream or sugar?
No, just tea.
Okay.
Thank you.
Of course, I'll take out all this tea and sugar part.
Well, yeah. Whatever. Some people actually put milk in it as well. Oh, and you're one of those people, aren't you?
I am, yes.
You mentioned about the plans being well received, and I wanted to just ask you about consultation and public participation in the planning you were involved with in the post-war era. In planning school and in a lot of texts that critique planning, there's this sort of narrative that not a lot of consultation was done in a lot of post-war planning, a lot of mega projects and so on, and that now planning is much more about that we have to go out, we have to listen to people and talk to people and share stories and engage in dialogue and negotiation. And I just wanted to know, in the projects that you were involved with where you said the plans were well received, what was the consultation like and the public participation, what level?
Well, we did a lot of public presentation. There wasn't a hell of a lot of public interest at that time. For example, in the Saskatchewan period when I was there, when I did go to these small communities, there was no interest at all in the long-range view or in the planning ideas. Some of them were interested in the housing problems, and some of them were interested in transportation because of the confusion on the street, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, they were bit more or less farm-oriented, rural-oriented audiences, and I didn't get much response from them. Mm-hmm. When I left Metro Winnipeg, because the Metro government was simply abandoned by the provincial government. I went to work for another private firm, Davidson Smith, and I was with them for 8 years, I guess, quite a long time. And we did a lot of planning of communities.
Right. We're looking at a very, very long list of different plans that Dr. Levin worked on between 1972 and 1980, and it takes up a whole page. These were projects that you were involved with as part of this consulting firm.
Oh, yes. Indeed. Mm-hmm. I was actually the director of the Winnipeg office of Davidson Smith.
Mm.
The headquarters were in Toronto.
Mm.
And I really had fairly heavy responsibility in Winnipeg. And again, what can I say? The projects, the jobs, went all the way from the Edmonton Annexation Project, for example, or the Ontario Municipal Board hearings about the Bruce Farms. There were controversial issues sometimes between people who wanted something and people who wanted something else. And consultation came to me to decide, or at least to present the issue in planning terms, either way. And it was a very productive period. It went on for 8 years, I guess, but what actually happened ultimately, I really don't know. I did a Central Avenue Mall study for Swift Current in Saskatchewan. Gave them the plan, and what they did with it, I have no idea. Well, this is one of the characteristic disadvantages. One of the characteristic. I was going to say disadvantage, and I suppose in a way it was a disadvantage of being a consultant to a city or to a municipality or whatever that was remote from where you were. And you came in as an advisor, and your job was to advise them. And after that, it was up to them as to whether they were going to follow your advice or not. And if they had the establishment of first of all, the authority, and secondly, the personnel, the planning personnel, to carry out the proposals of the plan, it was their issue. See, I had no idea whether they did or not.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a matter of preparing this plan, handing it to the authority, getting the authority's approval for it, saying, and the authority saying, thank you very much, here's your fee, we'll take this to our staff, just if they have the planning staff, mm-hmm. or if not, we'll take it to the council and see whether the planning arm of the municipality can be created, mm-hmm. and be given the responsibility for implementing what you have suggested here.
You mentioned controversies, and in some of these projects that you were involved with competing interests. And as a consultant, what was your role in terms of mediating that conflict and getting involved in negotiating between parties and hearing from different sectors, different stakeholders?
Well, I obviously had an obligation to the authority that hired me. The differences of opinion weren't entirely, if at all, in the authority. It was in the commonality, in the community. And if it was expedient, and if it was advisable, I went to meetings in which there were the two communities, the two differences, points of view. But obviously, I had to favor the point of view that was more clearly planning disposed. If there was a planning disposition, logical, reasonable, mm-hmm. future-oriented position, then that's the one that I had to support. If there wasn't any such idea, if they were simply divided on the basis of whether this was a good business proposal or this was a good rural proposal or whether this was not a good business proposal, that was to be decided between them. But what I was there to advise them was that this was a good planning proposal.
Into the future.
I so advised the authority, and it was up to the authority to talk, mm-hmm. to take action one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But I did find that from time to time, I did have to talk to diverse groups that were in conflict with each other on what to do with the city or the town or whatever it was that mm-hmm. what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And all I could do, really, was to give them my point of view, which may not have coincided with the point of view of either the business community mm-hmm. or one particular phase of the business community, for example, the railway.
Right.
The railway on the one hand, or the land the land investment group on the other hand. Mm-hmm. excuse me. I suppose if it was a land investment issue, I could have spoken to them directly about the possible impact of this particular plan that I was proposing on land values and where the land values would probably arise. Mm-hmm. And it was a difference, I suppose, between central area development or immediately the rural area or the area next to the central area, closest to the central area. And I suppose I don't know what I may have proposed in the circumstance, but if my plan visualized a central area development, I had to say this was the key planning idea, the key planning concept that I'm working on here, because there is land available and there is demand available in this part of the downtown or the central area, but it hasn't got the same potential as the immediate area adjacent to the border. And if the land adjacent, what the hell do you call the land? The suburbs.
Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, the suburbs. If there's more land available in the suburbs, mm-hmm. and if it makes sense to propose a varied kind of development in the suburbs, then that's what I would propose. But obviously, there's a very limited kind of commercial development that would be appropriate in the suburbs, and that would have to be something to do with the railway, for example, and mm-hmm. The warehousing and that kind of thing. But if you're interested in a different kind of commercial development, which is more appropriate in the downtown or in the suburb, mm-hmm. the adjacent suburb,
right.
Well, then I have to make that proposal to you.
Right.
And there were one or two of situations in which I had to make that differentiation.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, one of the forces was very strong in the whole of the development of Western Canada was the business community, business investment, and one of the forces that was integral to the stimulation of the business investment was the railway.
Mm-hmm.
And if the railway came to Regina, or if the railway came to Winnipeg, there was an immediate burst of business interest.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't all very well planned. And in those instances where it required some straightening out or some knowledgeable suggestions, then I suppose the authority came to me and said, you know, can you straighten this out or can you make some proposals as to how to settle these differences?
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, the development during that whole period was the result of the railway location, which stimulated a very, very large amount of land development because of this possible residential as well as commercial development mm-hmm. that would have been stimulated by the development of a railway station
Yeah.
And making it a major railway stop. And all of them, Regina, Winnipeg, and Calgary as well, all had the same experience. The CPR with Regina and Winnipeg, and CN in Calgary, mm-hmm. and made an enormous impact on each of those communities. Before the railway came, in Calgary, for example, the major impetus came from the farming, the farm, rural development, the rural development. Mm-hmm. And the land was very good for raising cattle. And there was an enormous amount of cattle raising. And in addition to that, horses. And horse racing.
Yeah.
Horse racing. until the need for some sort of rational arrangement of the resources, the allocation of the land resources, became imperative, mm-hmm. in which case I asked the planning point of view from the professional planner. But mm-hmm. before they turned to the professional planner, it was the business interests which forced the development of mm-hmm. that town, or that city, that community.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I'd like to just pick up on one, the phrase you just used there about the need for rational planning decisions to be made about the distribution of land, and also about the economics that businesses were driving development. And this relates to the paper that you wrote for the Institute of Urban Studies, actually, on planning as a utopian ideology and mm-hmm. city government function. And in there you talk about a major disconnect between planning and all of these aspirations for it, for guiding not only rational development of land, but also the moral development of people and so on. And yet the very, very constrained and narrow abilities of municipal governments to actually carry these things out. Mm-hmm. And it's a very thought-provoking idea, and I'd like to ask you first of all how you came to think about planning in this way over your career. Were you utopian when you started out in planning, and what sort of led you to realize that planning needed to be reframed? That the kind of theory that was being taught to students wasn't reflecting reality.
Well, I don't know whether I was consciously utopian or not, but one of the phenomena that bothered me was the emphasis, the power that the business community had initially in those early years. And they didn't care very much about anything other than the business investment. And there were the occasions when landscaping also was an important thought in terms in the minds of the city council, for example, or even in the minds of the residential business development, because they were smart enough to understand that if an area was barren, didn't have the same kind of draw upon potential residential development as an area that was landscaped or that was fertile or that was green. Mm-hmm. So there was a period in most of the places that I was involved in which park development became a very major public mm-hmm. expenditure. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but in some instances it was even privately financed. But park development without the provision of an adjacent residential area or the availability of the park to a residential community was something that they understood, and yet wasn't always the implementing sort of force. But at one time, a park was developed, and the anticipated residential development didn't occur, and the park simply disappeared eventually. Mm-hmm. But then I recognized the fact, ultimately, that a park isn't only a visual amenity. It can be a social amenity. It can be a moral amenity. It can be an immoral amenity as well. But I began to think that there ought to be a close linkage between all of the so-called amenities of the environment with the social contract. There's a relationship between human beings and their environment. And when I say human beings, I mean in their totality. And that relationship was very, very tenuous. It's very, very thin, if it existed at all. And I began to feel that, well, you know, there should be a linkage between residential development and the accompanying park amenity that supports the moralistic and the humanistic side of that residential development. And just to give you a contemporary, a current point of view, for the last 13 years, before coming back to Winnipeg, I lived in Victoria, and I lived in a condominium apartment building. I lived on the 7th floor, which was the top floor of this building. And there were 34 residential units in that building. The only communication that I and my wife had with the other 33 residents was when we met in the elevator on our way out or in the lobby on our way in or out. It was the only communication we had. Mind you, we had two very lovely terraces, well, outside.
Yeah. Patios.
Patios. Well, they were sort of decks.
Mm.
Very attractive. One of them looked south and the other looked east. Mm-hmm. And both of them had a very, very pleasant overview. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, this is fine, but we're living in a commune of some kind, and we have absolutely no idea what the hell's going on. And I have now thought that for every residential development, particularly these condominium developments, mm-hmm. they ought not to go up very high.
Mm-hmm.
And as an integral part